We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about cities, and particularly big modern cities, places like New York, for example, or Chicago, or Shanghai, or Tokyo, for that matter, and the way that the city as a place shapes us. Our guest for the program is Mark Kingwell. He's professor of philosophy at University of Toronto, and he says that the modern city is the most significant machine that humans have ever produced. At the same time, cities are living things. They grow in ways that sometimes are planned and sometimes not. But certainly one thing is true, that while we indeed do shape the cities where we live, the cities where we live also shape us. These are some of the ideas that he deals with in a book that he wrote and was published a couple of years ago. The title of his book is Concrete Reveries, Consciousness and the City. That's published by Viking. He is visiting here at the campus of the University of Illinois and will give a talk. And this is, it's both the Philosophy Department annual lecture and the School of Architecture Max Abramowitz Distinguished Lecture. That's this afternoon at 5:30 in the Plym Auditorium of Temple Buell Hall. I'll be talking on this subject. And this is open to anybody who's interested. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to stop by and hear what he has to say, you can certainly do that. And here on the program, we do these shows to bring the guest and their ideas to the biggest audience possible. So if you want to participate here, you can call in, send us an email, whatever you would like to do. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. In addition to his teaching, Mark Kingwell does a lot of writing. He's contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. He's often interviewed on television, radio, often on the CBC. His work has concentrated on philosophy, art, and architecture, but he has a wide interest. He's also written on trout fishing and also the place of the cocktail in the literary and social world. So one could go out and sample any of those subjects, but here this morning we're talking about the city. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
One thing that I guess it's interesting, or I think about is as people think about ways to divide up the world in various ways, maybe one of the oldest ways has been to think about the world in terms of cities and their environs and everything else. And there has, I'm sure, been a very long tendency of people to think of the city as representing all of the worst things that you get when you concentrate people in together.
Yeah, there's this really interesting kind of metaphorical weight that goes with the city, especially in distinction to what's outside, mm-hmm. the country, the rural. So the city is the site of sin, but also of protection because it has the walls, also of commerce and excitement. And then the countryside, the rural, is simplicity, a kind of bucolic restfulness or something of that kind. So the metaphor is interesting because it can reverse polarity almost without warning. So suddenly the country now might be seen as a place of isolation and the city as a place of comradeship and stimulation. And really in the 20th century, through the history of the 20th century, with significant figures like Georg Simmel, who starts writing about the metropolitan attitude, which mm-hmm. is the attitude that craves excitement and novelty and stimulation, sexual opportunity, proximity of commercial opportunities. So that the city then becomes increasingly through the course of the 20th a site of desire and destination. And what's fascinating now, of course, in the first part of the 21st, is that for the first time in human history, more people live in cities than don't on the globe. And we are just barely coming to understand what the implications of that fact are.
Yeah, it's just really remarkable, and you can see it happening all over the place, and particularly in, well, everywhere, but particularly in developing countries, where the city is a magnet because it's considered to be the place where opportunity lies. Sadly enough, in a lot of places, that's for a lot of people who go there, that's not the case. Just living in an urban environment doesn't certainly mean that you have a good life. But that people see that as being maybe almost their only alternative.
Yeah, very much so. And if the history of human civilization for a long time was the history of agriculture, of cultivating land to produce food, we have now decisively passed into a post-agricultural moment, a technological moment. This is not controversial. But what it does is suspend large chunks of the global population in this kind of in-between status. And as you mentioned, many of the largest cities in the world now, cities over 15 or even 20 million, can be found in the so-called underdeveloped world. Mm-hmm. And the consequences for that are just as poorly understood as the general picture. So concentrating on large first world cities is not yet to address some of these geopolitical movements, but it does give us a way to think about how cities work and don't work. And given that most of us now, and increasingly more of us, live in cities, we need to start that thinking if we're going to address the geopolitical consequences down the line.
Yeah. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how you approach this as a philosopher, simply because I think probably most people, as they think of philosophy and what philosophy does, they think of it as being as a rather inner-focused sort of business, you know, all about what's going on inside and what we know about that, and not so much about what's going on outside.
Yeah, my route to this particular cluster of interest is a bit circuitous. I did study in graduate school with a philosopher who wrote and thought about architecture, Karsten Harries at Yale University. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize until some years later that he had planted a seed in my mind to come back to this. I started my career as a philosopher, and it's still a central part as a political theorist. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the nature of justice and political justification, democratic legitimacy, things of that kind. And but I had side interests in philosophy of art, and eventually through that started thinking about architecture. And what frustrated me, and I think this is true for other philosophers who write about the built environment, is that architects are very good at thinking about how buildings work and even how cities work in one sort of perspective. But when they use philosophy, often, maybe too often, they do it in the sort of dust jacket form where it's mm-hmm. sort of, or window dressing, to keep a building metaphor, where it's just a sort of show to bolster their particular vision. But on the other side, there's an equally difficult blind spot, which is that political theorists, by and large, don't think of people as living, breathing creatures who have to have houses, who have to have toilets, who have to have stoves, mm-hmm. And that they interact or don't interact in public spaces and in the contested circulatory parts of a city, like the streets and the sidewalks. So I got to the point where I thought, you can't do political theory without addressing the built environment in which politics actually is played out. And in some ways, it's a very old insight. You can find a version of it in Plato, but it gets lost in most contemporary political theory, with some exceptions. You know, Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition talks about the space of appearances, which is, you know, where we appear to each other. But it's a kind of, sort of willful repression, maybe, yeah, on the part of political theory. Yeah. So this was my impetus for starting to write about the city in a both architectural and political way.
Well, it seems to me to be a rather natural sort of thing to do, in the sense that what you know what can happen with a city is you've got a critical mass of people, and that can result in a lot of really exciting things going on, a lot of creativity, challenging established notions of the way that you do things. But on the other hand, it also can result in really significant alienation. And so then you have to ask, well, what are the features of the city and city life that would lead to one or the other? Well, both. They lead to both, clearly. So what it really is going on there.
Yeah, and this, in a way, makes the city the natural site for political reflection, because it's a microcosm of all the challenges of accommodation and respect and civility and legitimation. All of the central ideas of political theory are played out in real terms, in real time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can even focus down more sharply. I've written more recently, since this book was published, specifically on the issue of public space and what makes public spaces work or not work, what sorts of discourse surrounds them. And every city has, you go anywhere, and talk to some people who've been there for a while, and sooner or later they'll say, yeah, there's this square down here which the city council wanted to, you know, privatize, or the commercial interests were trying to buy it up, or there's a park over here where a real estate developer wanted to carve a chunk out and build monster homes. Every city is dealing with this at this intersection of the public and the private.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Mark Kingwell. He's professor of philosophy at University of Toronto. We're talking about some of the ideas you will find in his book, Concrete Reveries. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll talk about some of these things this afternoon. That's open to anybody who would like to attend, but certainly the conversation here is open to anybody who would like to plunge in make a comment, ask a question, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about the title and about how it is that you start in the book, because in a concrete way, you talk about concrete, which is an interesting material in the sense that for some people it has a real appeal, and you can do interesting stuff with concrete. But it's also, you know, when you think of something that's hard and harsh and gritty and unattractive. Things you want to complain about. Well, you know, it's the same thing. You know, how can it be both?
It's funny when a straw poll of people about concrete creates an interesting kind of mini discourse all of its own. It may be the most reviled material in the history of architecture, but I happen to love it, and I know lots of other people who do. And it's partly because the despising comes, I think, from the what came to be typical uses of it in what's sometimes called brutalist architecture from the 1960s and 70s. And even that stuff I have a certain fondness for, because it's very much of its period. But the big slabs of free pour, or the prefab concrete that people were confronted by in public buildings, especially, very alienating, very tough. But concrete itself is such a great material because it's infinitely plastic. I like to compare it to batter, you know, like you would make a cake out of. It can be poured into any shape. It can be molded. And it has so much texture and range of possibilities that nowadays, especially when you see architects who really are thinking about it, you see deployments of concrete that are much more impressive and aesthetically accessible. Mm-hmm. But the very idea of concreteness runs through the book too, and it's partly because there's this background struggle in all philosophical reflection between the abstract and the concrete, that presumed dichotomy. Philosophers are constantly being accused of being too abstract and not concrete enough, and some of us tie ourselves in knots trying to disprove that charge. I thought, well, why not just query the very idea of the value of concreteness, and at the same time take philosophical reflection of a sort of drifting, not aimless, but kind of a flaneur type of philosophical reflection, wandering productively in a reverie. And so this combination of concreteness and the reverie is the overall feeling that I was trying to create in the book.
Yeah. That seems curious to me, on the one hand, that people should feel the way they do about concrete, because in one way of thinking what concrete is, it's a kind of a synthetic stone. We don't really think about stone the same way that we think about concrete.
Yeah, I think I can't understand why people don't have, say, the same ambivalence about glass, which is equally subject to bad deployments in architecture. The persistence of the glass box, even past the point when, back in the 1960s, a bunch of architects said, you know, we'll never build another glass box again. But glass boxes are constantly being erected, usually as renovations of museums. So glass is, I think, a much more insidious material, actually, because it's open, apparently open appeal. Disguises a kind of banality in its use, for the most part. There are exceptions. But yeah, poor old concrete has a bad rap.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. In Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I hope that things are apropos in the sense of what's going on in the Middle East. Every station you turn to, radio or TV, they're talking about their gathering at Babylon Square. So I would like for you to talk about that from your philosophical stance. And just a footnote to the thing about concrete and glass. Usually if you have something you believe in and it comes out to be two different things, you have to examine your assumptions. I guess that's what I'd be doing. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by this, as I'm sure most of us have been glued to our screens, watching these mass gatherings in public squares. And I kept thinking about 19th century Paris, where in the wake of the upheavals of the previous century, there was a kind of obliteration of existing street plan. And Baron von Haussmann's Haussmannization of Paris, which created the arrondissement system, but also the wide open streets, the plazas and boulevards like Champs Elysees, which create what the opportunity for a cavalry countercharge whenever there's a public demonstration that gets out of hand, whereas before it was the small narrow streets, the warrens of Paris, which allowed a kind of guerrilla resistance to the larger powers. In these cases today, we see what were created as grand ceremonial plazas being retaken by the people who are coming out of their houses and finding this kind of electric energy. And public spaces always have that possibility, but they're contested territories. That's the thing. Even when nothing violent is happening, is it a space for enjoyment? Is it a space for resistance? Is it in fact a kind of stealth commercial or state-controlled space, as many allegedly public spaces are. So that it's no surprise to me that this is where people go, you know, when they want to demonstrate just their willingness to be part of something. Every city should have such a place where we all know that this is the place we should be going, that we'll see all of our fellow citizens there. In fact, of course, not every city has any such thing.
Yeah. Well, in fact, if you look at newer cities, and in the book you look at two cities and do a major kind of compare and contrast, both modern cities, but one maybe more of a 20th century city, that's New York, and the other maybe the 21st century of the city. That's kind of the way that you set it up.
Right.
You know, modern city, yes, New York, but city of the future, Shanghai. And when you look at places like that, or places that you would think of as being very, very futuristic cities, do they in fact have those kinds of spaces?
That's a great question. And so, yeah, just to clarify, I use these two examples as both themselves, but also as devices of interpretation to open up this transition to the 21st out of the I think of New York as the kind of the modernist city par excellence. But now we're into a postmodern or something like that urban reality. Mm-hmm. In Shanghai, as in Beijing, there are large people's public squares, with some exceptions that we know, for the most part, they don't feel available to the people in any political sense. They're much more they give off the vibe of projecting a kind of image of the state. As it's enjoying its control or its power, as opposed to being available in a kind of impromptu gathering place or anything of the kind. So Shanghai is a very interesting city in that way, that it's a very city of more than 20 million, which doesn't feel like it has a kind of collective identity. On the contrary, it's a whole bunch of individuals very busily going about their business. It's a vibrant commercial city. But there's no sense there of the Shanghainese as a community. That at least is my impression. Now things are changing as China is being liberalized, whether it likes it or not, by political subversions here and there. But still, the presence of the state is never far away.
Well, this whole question of what is the meeting spot, I think is interesting and leads to the question. Is that something that just happens in a way? And can that be purposely created, or do people somehow manage to decide what that's for themselves, what that place is?
Well, experience shows us that you can never guarantee your intentions as an architect or as a planner. you can try, and sometimes it works out the way you want it. But it's always the people who decide ultimately. So this is not a political example, but it goes to the sense of the subtitle of the book is Consciousness in the City, and the way people experience themselves in the city. I tell a story of a philosophy paper actually from some years ago where people were asked to try to solve a problem, which was to meet a friend in New York without benefit of any communication device. So no cell phones, no texting, but also no way to get in touch even by old media. Mm-hmm. And a majority of people, this is a very early example of what now would be called experimental philosophy, or X-Fi for short, if you want to be.
I like that.
Yeah, I didn't come up with it, but if you want to be a cutting edge nerd about philosophy, X-Fi is where the action allegedly is. But you ask people, and what they say is, to a strong consensus, that you should go to the information kiosk, the famous one with the globe clock at the center of the concourse at Grand Central Terminal, mm-hmm. at noon, right? High noon at the clock. And what makes that so fascinating to me is that without any kind of imposition of rules or directives or even spoken agreement, that is the right answer. And if you had to do it, it probably would work, because your friend somewhere else in Manhattan would know that that also was the right answer for him or her. And that's the kind of thing that's fascinating about consciousness in a city. And it shows you, just as an example, of the many unplanned, spontaneous, Jane Jacobs liked to call them dancing movements of the way people actually live and experience the world of their city. So you mentioned right at the beginning that I play with all these different metaphors of the city: machine, market, circulation device. But ultimately, the best metaphor is that the city is like a person. It's a kind of embodied consciousness. Mm-hmm. There's the physical, the material realities of it, which are changing. But there's also the lived experience, the way that the people both here now and in the past and to come suffuse that material basis with life, with desire and intention.
Our guest in this hour is Mark Kingwell. He's professor of philosophy at University of Toronto and is very much interested in philosophy, art, architecture. If you'd like to explore some of his ideas on this subject here we're talking about, you can look for a book that he authored. The book's titled Concrete Reveries, Consciousness, and the City. It's published by Viking here in the U.S. Came out a couple of years ago. I'm sure you can find it. He's visiting the campus and will give a talk this afternoon, and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. This is the Philosophy Department's annual public lecture, and also the School of Architecture, Abramovitz Distinguished Lecture, 5:30 this afternoon in the Plym Auditorium of Temple Buell Hall, talking about this very subject, Concrete Reveries, the City as a Work of Art. So that's something, if you're here locally, you can take in, and if you want to join the conversation, you certainly can. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have somebody else here to talk with in the community of Belgium nearby, not too far away, line 4. Hello. Yeah, hi.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Couple of things I'd like to talk to you about here. First one is there are two types of concrete, sir, and there are the concrete that has cracked and the concrete that is going to crack. And I bring this up because I look at something like Falling Water, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's beautiful building. But the problem with it is he made it out of concrete, and it has a lot of material failures going on to it, and they're trying very hard to put it back so it's nice. So concrete has its place, but not everywhere. But the other thing I wanted to bring up, too, and I would like you to discuss, too, is I find it very interesting. You're talking about cities and the attractiveness of it, but it seems like almost everybody that's in a city wants a country home or wants to go back to their home. Take China. Everybody in China, Chinese New Year, they all want to go back to their village. Everybody in the United States wants to leave the city for summer vacation or wherever and go to the country. Seems like everybody's trying to escape the city as much as they're trying to get into it.
Well, let me take the first point first. You're absolutely right that a lot of concrete, especially as it has aged, has not aged well. And there are even worse problems than just its cracking. Some of the old concrete has toxic materials in it that actually come off as gases, toxic gases, or as poisoning of the groundwater where it's built. And that also always reminds me of, I think it was P.J. O'Rourke who had a good line about all the Soviet concrete that was built in the 1950s and 60s, and it was made out of potatoes, sand, and lard, or some such combination. So there are different degrees of quality in concrete. As there, it's not just one thing. That's absolutely true. Although I don't subscribe to the cracked, not cracked dichotomy. I think that's a little reductive. Some concrete will last better than others. That is true. On the second question, I don't myself feel this desire. I guess I'm a city kid, born and raised, and I understand the appeal of the country. But as a retreat, or as a kind of a rustication, which is the great old word for taking your leisure in the country, I understand that it's deeply bound up with our sense of ourselves as urban people. That as a retreat, I don't think most of us would actually want to live in the country full time. It's more that it's the contrast that we want, just as any vacation or holiday is a contrast to everydayness. One thing that's now increasingly obvious is that living in the country is highly inefficient when it comes to natural resources, especially energy. And cities are much more efficient. This is contrary to what most people believe. Cities are much more efficient environmentally, much less damaging to the ecosphere than the country living.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. On to another caller here. This is someone on our line number one, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked in Chicago, in the near north, the brownstones. So maybe you can comment on that. And also, I also like some of the brick buildings, some of the high rises, that kind of thing. So, but one that I'm really interested is the trend toward gardening in the city. This isn't certainly in England, the small gardens and all that kind of stuff. So what do you think this can trend, whether this will be a bigger trend or not? So anyway, I'll just ring off and let you talk.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I'm glad we got around to Chicago, because I was hoping that would come up, that one of the most architecturally interesting cities in the world, not news to anybody. And there are so many great buildings to talk about. My favorite, just for the record, is the Monadnock Building, which is named for a mountain in New Hampshire and has a kind of mountainous presence down inside the loop. But the brownstones are fascinating, because you find brownstones in some North American cities and not in others where you might expect to find them. So there are none in Toronto, for example, and partly it's material. So there's a lot of red brick in Toronto because in the Don Valley, which is part of the larger city area, there were obvious stores of clay that made excellent bricks, but no quarries nearby to produce the kind of sandstone that is typical of the brownstones. But I love the way the brownstone is designed. So the ones in Brooklyn, the ones in near North Chicago, with the big broad steps up and the down apartments, and it's a very democratic way of living. And the only equivalent I can think of is the large buildings in Edinburgh and Scotland in Morningside, which have a kind of communal staircase and large flats in blocks built in the 18th and 19th centuries, such that, this is the point, you come into contact with your neighbors. And there's a certain negotiation of the stairwell or the stoop or the sidewalk or all of them, which is a kind of essential enabling condition of democracy, in contrast to the suburban, exurban sprawl typical of much of American building from, say, 1960 to 1980 and on, still happening in my city, and flew over some coming into Champaign the other day. It's happening here, where people are, though still physically proximate, living in houses where they enter the house through the garage sometimes. You drive your car right into the garage and there's a door that goes into the pantry. You don't even have to see your neighbors, let alone interact with them. So there's a tension here that goes back to the earlier point. The city is an opportunity, but it's also a kind of demand. It's a demand that you interact and find ways of solving problems in an everyday way, which really in many senses is the essence of democracy. The gardening thing, I think, is I'm just learning how controversial it is for some people, and in particular the use of water. So people are gardening and they're raising their own food, but it's actually quite inefficient in terms of water supply. Takes much more water than, say, just having a lawn. And I know that there's a tension politically on this issue now. The English model is probably better. That's where you would have no garden in your inside the town, but there would be a set of plots outside the town, which would just be agricultural land subdivided. And you would go out there and tend your plot and raise your courgettes or whatever else you want to put on the table. So there, you know, the idea of raising your own food is, I think, appealing to many people, but there are associated costs that have to be taken into account.
Yeah. I have an email question here from someone who has obviously spent some time reading philosophy, who wants to know whether you have any comment on Heidegger's interpretation of the city and whether it is explored in the book.
Yes and yes. Heidegger's ideas about architecture, technology, are central to my thinking, as they are for most people who come at this subject philosophically. The most important insight, I think, that we can get from him is, again, attention, so that there's the celebration of dwelling as a human possibility. And for him, dwelling is not just living somewhere, but it's to be, in a strong sense, at home. And to find an accommodation where you can work out your human possibilities and think about, you know, the meaning of your existence. That's the positive side. On the other side, I mentioned before, living decisively in a technological age, the question concerning technology, as Heidegger asks it, is what is it doing to us and the world? And the answer is making us and the world available for use, making us into a kind of natural resource or raw material, which is then placed as something available to be used, which is quite a different way of thinking about, you know, it's the difference between a forest as a place you go to think and a forest as potential lumber. And this essence of technology suffuses all of our thinking. I mean, this is, again, this is not going to be news to anybody. Philosophers don't typically bring the news. They say the things that are obvious in ways that are meant to trouble you. That's what we're up to, as far as I'm concerned. And we're so deeply immersed in our gadgetry, our devices, that we are not examining our desires, to use an old quotation.
Well, for those of you who are troubled, if you'd like to call in and ask questions, they'd certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Mark Kingwell. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. I'd like to have to come back and maybe have you talk a little bit more. We were talking earlier about this, you know, about concrete and making things concrete, maybe about the way that cities indeed take some of our values, particularly political values, and make them concrete.
Yeah, well, I said it before, in a negative sense, the way that state control might shape the city to its own self-protection. Yeah. And I think what frustrates many people when they think about architecture is precisely this, that they feel they have no influence over it. And so something that they see as monstrous just goes up in a neighborhood, and they've had no say in how that works. And I appreciate that frustration. The only thing to say, I think, is that people need to be more actively interested and engaged with the architecture of their city, because that quote you read at the beginning is, of course, a paraphrase of Winston Churchill, that first we shape buildings and then the buildings shape us. In that sense, every building is political, because every building goes into a public realm, which is the realm of shared experience of the city, and affects us. And, you know, unlike other kinds of gestures, they're usually around for a while. You know, you can knock buildings down eventually, but you have to live with them for some years. And it may not strike, every building may not strike us as political, but in that sense, they are. It's more pointed when we're talking about public buildings, public spaces, or especially that threshold between the public and the private that I mentioned. So when a developer acquires some land and then gets it zoned for commercial use, that is a political series of actions. And I think a lot of us are not paying enough attention to that, especially if we feel like, well, we've got our residential area and it's okay. But we live in the whole city. You know, we don't just live in our homes. And that this is, I think, essentially a political investigation. There are other places that that this comes up, places of shared experience like stadiums and arenas, you know, the public spectacles. These too are political things. So in Canada right now, there's a big debate about new hockey arenas in various cities and whether or not or to what extent they should be publicly financed. And so, you know, you might think, again, a hockey game, going to see a hockey game is not a political act. But of course it is, because it takes place in this controversial space of the arena.
One of the things you write about as a feature of the city that I think it can be very interesting is in terms of the built environment, there can be a tremendous variety. And depending upon, I guess, the attitude of people toward historic preservation, I expect we could find places even in this country where you'll still have some, maybe some 19th century buildings. You might even have some 18th century buildings and existing side by side with 20th century or more modern buildings, and this great sort of riot of stuff where you can have visionary architects who manage to have their visions made concrete, sitting right next to buildings that express the values and the architectural ideas of previous centuries. And I'm sure that there are some people would say, well, that's one of the cool things about a big city, is that you can walk along the street and you can see a lot of different ideas made manifest.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a couple of different dimensions along which we experience this. The sensitivity of a new building to its surround, as architects like to call it, is one of the key features of how people respond to it, especially in the first instances. And we were talking about landmarks earlier, and sometimes you can self-consciously create a landmark, and sometimes a landmark just comes out of the people's use of a building. Aldo Rossi, who was a great Italian architecture theorist, talked about landmarks as reorienting the geography of the city. They also reorient the history of the city, so that you can no longer think about that history without, as it were, going through that building. And this is what I find fascinating. It's a version of the logic of inheritance, that you cannot build or experience without confronting the past and the intentions and values of that past. I find it exhilarating. I even find it fascinating when you look at, this is another dimension, a city like New York, even though there's historical preservation, is quicker than many places to obliterate and build over. But what you get then is a kind of layering, a palimpsest of the city. So that sometimes literally you can look down in Wall Street, for example, there are some exposed subterranean areas. So they've actually got glass brick, places that you can look down and see the history of the city sedimented beneath the sidewalk. And I love that sense of the historical layering. And New York, relatively speaking, is still a newish city. So anywhere has this, and it's part of the joy of attending to the built environment that you find yourself in.
Yeah. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about Shanghai. People will be at least a little bit more familiar with New York or with Chicago, and think of those as modern cities. But you also think about this other city that I suppose you call it city of the future, call it postmodern or something, whatever kind of language. There was something different, something fundamentally different in what's going on there than even what's going on now today in a place like New York.
Yeah, I talk about obliteration. For a long stretch, several decades, Shanghai was hell-bent on really just wiping clean its historical record. And until some people started saying, hang on a second, we're losing some really interesting things like the old courtyard style of residential building. And so some of those have been preserved. But yeah, huge chunks of Shanghai have been built almost as if they were downloaded from a kind of cosmic science fiction program in the sky. The every style of imagined building, all the kinds of crazy things that we saw in cartoons and movies in the 60s, you can find it there. And part of what I'm going to talk about tonight is this looping effect between the imagination and the reality of buildings. And so architects there, for obvious reasons, they were not constrained by public interest groups or even by building codes in some cases. There was plenty of money because the Beijing government really wanted to make Shanghai a kind of showcase city for its commercial expansions. And architects from all over the world were building there with a degree of freedom which probably hadn't been seen since maybe the early part of the 20th century in New York and Chicago. And so they have created a remarkable city. Many of these buildings lie largely empty. You know, they stretch 80, 90, 100 stories into the sky and nobody's using them. So they almost become monuments to a certain sort of hybrid hyper-capitalism under statist control. You know, it's really something that we have not before witnessed. Mm-hmm. And Shanghai is not the only place, but it is the best crucible for all of these things. It's much more a real city still than, say, Dubai, which also has many architectural wonders and travesties. But Dubai is a kind of almost entirely imaginary place. Shanghai is a real city with a real history. And so there's this I think, raw energy there that anybody who's interested in these things, you put Shanghai on your bucket list because it's a remarkable place.
One more caller at least here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd just like to make a local comment because I'm concerned about, you know, when the guest was talking about people having a say-so. There's a couple of buildings in Champaign that bother me a lot, and the only chance I ever get to say anything might be today. It's the one that replaced the old Burnham Hospital, and it's the one called M2. Both of those buildings look like they've been made out of the cheapest materials, and the M2 building has this arbitrary change of sidings of different colors of bricks and some kind of panels. And I look at that and I think that building's going to be there a long time. It is extremely homely. The parking garage looks better than it does. I just wanted to be able to say that in case anybody else had that same idea about it, because there seems to be an architectural firm or somebody who's prevalent in this area. And it's of concern to me because the buildings are unremarkable or remarkably unremarkable. Just wanted to say that. Thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know if this is a relatively new for our town here in terms of scale. It's a large building. It's condominiums and apartments, and then it has some retail space on the ground level. And in recent years, a number of buildings like that have been built in Champaign-Urbana. It's certainly altered the skyline, if nothing else. Mm-hmm.
Well, as I said earlier about public spaces, everywhere you go, there are going to be these buildings that are controversial and that people are finding obtrusive. I wasn't in Paris, but I just was looking at some photos that my stepdaughter sent me from Paris and from the Luxembourg Gardens, which is one of the most beautiful parts of Paris. Now, on one, just as a kind of it looks like a, you know, an extended middle finger, actually standing up about 25 stories, this modernist building, which is completely out of place to the surrounding aesthetic. And this just seems like a mistake, you know, and whatever commercial or political interests played into that mistake. I can't speak to the Champagne one because I haven't seen it, but there are genuine architectural mistakes. But I want to say that unfortunately, for many people, they move quickly from that view to the view that all modernist architecture or even all new or newish architecture is bad. And you know, I suppose the most famous advocate of that view is Prince Charles in Britain, who at a swipe condemned all modernist architecture. And one of the triumphs of a great city like London is precisely that there are some buildings which were challenging and might have seemed out of place, but which assert themselves over time such that they come to be part of the fabric of the city. I'm thinking of Norman Foster's famous Gherkin building, which many people still think is goofy, but I love it. And I think the way it sits in that part of the neighborhood near the Thames is actually quite brilliant. But it's a negotiation, and sometimes negotiations fail, or they might succeed with me but fail with you. And that's part of the conversation that the built environment has to inspire.
Well, people do get used to things, or they change their minds about them. Not meaning to compare the building that Gawler was talking about with the Eiffel Tower, but since we were talking about Paris, I guess I do think about the fact that when the Eiffel Tower was built, a lot of people hated it. And I would assume now that perhaps at this point most Parisians have made their peace with the Eiffel Tower, and it is one of those iconic buildings that stands for a place.
Absolutely.
But,
yeah.
but at least initially, a lot of people did not like that structure.
No,
that's
true. And I think it was Honoré Balzac who said that he would eat lunch at the cafe at the top of the Eiffel Tower every day because it was the only spot in Paris where he didn't have to look at the Eiffel Tower. And as you say now, love it or hate it, it is the instantly recognizable sign of Paris or even of Frenchness. Yeah, it's kind of synecdoche of the French. Yeah. And I happen to love it, actually, just because it's one of the most interesting structures in its material that's ever been built. Remarkable use of cross-hatching and latticing. Beautiful. But... yeah, absolutely right. People initially, a lot of people thought it was an eyesore. And now for many, especially for visitors who retain memories of Paris, Paris would not be Paris without the Eiffel Tower.
Just we have a couple of minutes left. I was when you were thinking about Shanghai and then mentioned Dubai, I guess I was also thinking about the fact that now there are some places around the world where people actually have the money and resources to construct somebody's vision of the city of the future. I go back to thinking about how some modernist architects, people like Le Corbusier and Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, people like that, on paper designed cities which were never built and probably should not have been built among other things, because I think that they had no consideration at all for their environmental impact. But in any case, that, you know, such a thing, you know, they could exercise their imagination. The possibility of building such a thing was pretty remote. Well, now at least there are some places where you actually could. Somebody could and has come along and designed, given free rein to their imagination, and such a thing can actually be built. And I wonder whether we will actually see more of those experiments, and we'll find out how they were.
I think right now we're probably not going to see more of them for a while, just given the way the economy is gone. But I think we're going to look back on this period as a period of remarkable conceptual architecture or experimental architecture. Mm-hmm. And this has always been one of the tensions, that architecture is called an applied art, or a third realm between natural beauty and fine art beauty. It's a realm of beauty, but also of use. And what the history of architecture shows us, the Empire State Building I wrote a whole book about the Empire State Building, which we haven't even talked about, my favorite building in the whole world, but was nicknamed the Empty State Building for decades because it was built but never used in its full capacity. Hmm. And this idea of the vision of the architect and the tension of beauty and use runs through our experience of the built environment. I love that there are these experiments out there. There's a big firm in Toronto called Young & Wright who were invited to make a massive development in Dubai. And, you know, they were practically doing cartwheels down the aisles because architects rarely get to do. I mean, we heard a lot about celebrity architects and visionary architects, but in fact, architects rarely get to do exactly what they want. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those cases. We will enjoy having those projects around, even if they never are used or inhabited in the ways that we typically think the built environment should be.
Yeah. So give me a minute on the Empire State Building.
Oh, okay. So speaking of iconic buildings, if the Eiffel Tower says Frenchness, the Empire State Building says New York, and even I say it's an expression of the American dream. Built in the Depression, well, the last big depression, but the current one, just through sheer force of will, unlikely financing, also a technological triumph. It was the tallest building in the world for the longest time that any building has ever held that title. Nowadays, you know, they add a new story in Taipei or Kuala Lumpur, and there's a tallest building practically every week, Dubai, mm-hmm. The Burj Dubai. But the Empire State Building is as the most significant 20th century building, caps the modernist period. It is the crowning achievement of modernism. And then it becomes a kind of a piece of raw material for all kinds of representations and in films, you know, in An Affair to Remember, as, you know, Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr, as people often know, trying to meet at the top of the Empire State Building, postcards, ephemera, models. So it has this whole kind of economy of reproduction. Which outstrips any other building. So it's endlessly fascinating for a philosopher like me who's interested in architecture to think about art, representation, politics, materials, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, Mark Kingwell, is professor of philosophy at University of Toronto. He'll be giving a talk on the subject that we have been talking about one way or another here this morning, Concrete Reveries, the City as a Work of Art, this afternoon, 5:30. This is the Philosophy Department annual lecture and the School of Architecture, Abramowitz Distinguished Lecture, 5:30 this afternoon, Plym Auditorium, Temple Buell Hall on the campus. Anybody's welcome. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.